Good evening. We have seen to this moment that there is one key word which leads you to lifting the veil of the Bible, and that key word is transformation. When you use this as your Geiger counter, you're going to discover gold. Every time you look at every passage in the Bible and sift it through the word transformation, a deeper meaning will become visible to your understanding. You will see beneath the letter of the word into the spiritual essence of it, and you will see how everything in the teaching and in the mission of Jesus is to gear us to that transformation. Now then, the literal readings of the Bible, which are unaware of the word transformation as the key, leave us cold. They leave us with words without power. And this is most apparent when it comes to the category of prayer. Now the disciples said to Jesus, "Teach us, Master, how to pray." And so he gave them the Lord's Prayer. Your morning headlines tell you that the Lord's Prayer has not been received by the majority of the thinking populace around the universe. Something tells us that the Lord's Prayer has not yet been understood. It's very clear that if Jesus gave us this way of prayer, that its purpose was to unite us with the Father, so that in this state of oneness we might receive the allness of God. But when you read about race riots, war, epidemics, disasters of all kinds, poverty, overpopulation, disease, you must say, surely a good number of these have used the Lord's Prayer. Why was it ineffectual? Why, after all these thousands of years, are we still unable to use a very simple prayer and make it produce for us that understanding of God which brings a God experience into our lives? It's as if the Master never gave us that prayer. And so you begin to say to yourself, what have we done wrong? Is prayer meaningful? Or is it just some kind of a hope without a basis? Does prayer really bring the power of God into a person's experience? We know we've read many, there are bookshelves full, all kinds of books telling you how powerful prayer is. And then there's always a story about someone who had the back to the wall, and suddenly, lo and behold, they turned to God and they were saved. And I'm sure you've talked to many such people, and I have. We visit quite frequently. And only recently one of my students said to me, when I asked, "How do you pray?" The reply was, "Well, let's see. I sort of go over the problem and explain it to God. And then after I have sort of outlined what's wrong, I don't say, 'God, do me a favor,' anything. Oh, no, not like that. But I do say, 'Do what you think is right, God,' and then I just drop off and leave it up to God." Now, that sounds like a nice, gentle way to pray. And so I said to this individual, "Does it work?" "Oh, yes, it always works." "Well, that's wonderful. Do you have you gone to the doctor in the last 5 years? "Oh, yes, yes." "Well, why didn't you just pray instead of going to the doctor if it works?" "Well," and that was the end of that conversation. There was nothing more to say. You see, these assumptions that prayer does bring an answer from God, maybe a little more coincidental than we have been willing to see. I doubt that you'll ever find a human prayer that does bring an answer from God, although you can find perhaps thousands upon thousands of accounts of prayer that does bring an answer from God, and I am questioning them tonight. The thought being that if prayer to God from a human being is not effectual, then as we continue this giant hoax, we are turning away from that kind of prayer which is effective. We are turning our backs to that which we were taught by the Master. And as you compare the many prayer plans that have been given and foisted upon the public by many well-meaning teachers, you find that their resemblance to the Lord's Prayer is sort of out of shape. You can't even see a similarity. And now we're going to go a little deeper then into prayer. And the first thing you must realize is this. As you mull it over, you know you have prayed many times. As a matter of fact, as children we learn to pray. And our form of prayer is, Dear God, bless Daddy, bless Mommy, bless Brother, bless Sister. And then comes the request. Daddy needs a new pair of shoes, or Daddy lost his job. And please, God, help. And you know, when we become adults, we don't go much further than that. We carry on the same prayer, or we have learned by this time not to pray at all because it's useless. Or we just continue and muffle our ears up and figure, well, I'll shoot an arrow in the air. It's bound to land somewhere, maybe in God's lap, and maybe he'll read my message, and maybe he'll send some help. Now, the first problem in praying to God is this. Every human prayer is an insult to the intelligence of God. In the first place, we're saying that God is impotent, intolerant, indifferent, withholding, a liar. We're saying, God, there is something about which I know more than you know. And that's the premise of every prayer, that I know something God doesn't know. And right there, you can see how effective that prayer is going to be. I know, for instance, that there's a child in the next room who's going to die tomorrow, but God doesn't know that. So I'm going to go to God and tell him so. You can see how ridiculous it is. The egotism, which is unintended, is nevertheless there. That I am smarter than God. There is something about which God is ignorant, but I know about it. And so, Father, here are the facts that you ought to know. Now, the first thing there that we have done wrong is to take God and make him less than God in our own eyes, not all-knowing, and then to go to this not all-knowing God, who we have just decided is not godly anymore, and now we want him to act like God. You see, we've got a mixture of paradoxes there. Then we have other little tricks, which we're not aware of at the time we do them, because we're usually frantic with despair. We'll say something like, God, I have rheumatism. It will never occur to us that the Father has stated that we are made in his divine image and likeness, and now we're telling him that his divine image and likeness has rheumatism. And then, after having told him off that way, we ask him to quickly repair that. Or, we say, Father, I know you have said your universe is perfect. You pronounced it good. And I'm sure it is in most places, except where I am concerned. Now, here's the problem here. And so there we're saying, God, you're a liar. In another place, we're saying, God is impotent. We're saying, because there is an imperfection that I need God's help on, God didn't make a perfect universe. And all of this, mind you, is going on without the intention to insult God in the slightest. Now then, after we have finished our accusations about God's imperfect universe and how God was impotent and could not keep it perfect, and how God lied to us about telling us it was perfect, and how he's withholding something from us that we won't get unless we bring it to his attention, because he's a pretty forgetful, perhaps a doddering old fellow. And we like to say, oh, he's too busy to think of me, so I better send him a little telegram. All of these little dodges we use when what stares us in the face and which we refuse to accept is we simply do not know God at all. We do not know God aright, and so we pray amiss, as James told us. We don't even know ourselves aright, or the relationship between ourselves and God. And so this is a hit or miss, a juvenile method of prayer. And you can judge it by its results. You know, as we sit here in the next hour, in fact, the duration of this class, there will be 9,000 deaths in the world. And over 60% of those will be, number one, because they do not know God, and two, because not knowing God, they're completely unaware of how one does pray. Accepting Jesus as our teacher, we see that the prayer he gave us, when applied, when understood, when lived, could save every life that understands the meaning of that prayer, and instead of 2 million people dying every year, more than 50% of them from causes that are not natural, cancer, emphysema, accidents, stroke, heart disease. Ulcers. These are the result of not knowing one simple word, prayer. Now we have to look at the Lord's Prayer, and we have to see that all the sanctimonious and pious readings of it have done nothing to diminish the ills of the world, and through their camouflage of truth, have done much to prohibit our finding the weapon to diminish those ills. Our first reading will be more or less casual to get acquainted with it, then we'll go deeper, and perhaps we'll see in the Lord's Prayer our own way of life. A message of transformation which we can put into practice and which we can use to walk in the midst of the ills of this world untouched. That was his purpose, and the early disciples did practice this Lord's Prayer in its original intent. and did walk untroubled through the diseases and lacks and limitations which beset other people around them. Now, either this prayer has a meaning, or it is innocuous and should be forgotten. It was given with the greatest sacredness to the disciples of Jesus Christ. And it reveals many, many things that we have done in our human prayer, which is both ridiculous, ill-advised, misguided, and completely unable to make a contact with the God we allegedly are seeking to reach. Let's just read it through quickly to get its full content. You all know it as Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Now this particular prayer, with minor variations in Luke, is a treasure which contains the very secret of our relationship with God. It is not a prayer of supplication. It is not a prayer of requesting that God give us things. It is not a prayer that says, "Dear God, here's the situation down on earth. Now here's what we need." The entire temperament of this prayer is different. The trouble is that in spite of this prayer, just on the very next page, there's another one. People like it a little better. It's ask, seek, and knock, and to you it shall be given. Ask, and you shall receive. And the world has spent 2,000 years asking. That's easier. All you've got to do is ask. And if you don't receive, ask again and again and again. That's the one the world likes. But the Lord's Prayer is just something we like to sing. We get those shivers down our spine when a great tenor comes out there or a bass baritone. And everybody goes home happy, but the meaning is still not there in the people's heart. The very word Our Father established at that moment the brotherhood of man. And you could stop right there, and if you didn't accept the brotherhood of man, the rest of the prayer to you is meaningless. Our Father says that your Father is God, and my Father is God, and your parents' Father is God, and your child's Father is God, and every nation's Father is God, and every sect, and every religion, and every creed, and every color. And so in one word, he established that God is the Father of the universe. Think of all the prayers that have been uttered. Dear God, that so-and-so, look what he's done to me. Let's do something about him. You're talking about the child of God. And so that prayer is shot before you start. The very intent, the very temperament of the prayer that does not recognize that every individual who ever has been and ever will be is the child of God, that prayer can never succeed. You can't pray, for example, that a business deal goes through in your favor. What about the other fellow? He's the child of God. You see, we cannot swing the scales in our favor, not for an instant. No prayer of that nature is recognizing the unbiased position of the Father. All we can do is let the matter rest in the Father's hands with the knowledge that that which is right will be. We can't influence God. To attempt it is to nullify the prayer. We can't persuade God. We can't bribe God. And of course, all the time we're doing this praying, we're praying to a God outside of ourselves. And there is no such God. There never has been a God outside of yourself. If you and God are not indivisible and inseparable, then God is not all. There's God, and then there's you too. And now you've lost God. You've divorced yourself. You're on a little island somewhere, praying up to this great super God. But the kingdom of God is within you. Our Father, which art in heaven. Now let's not place heaven up there in the sky. We ought to know by now that heaven is a state of consciousness, not a place. Our Father, which art in heaven. Where am I? I'm on earth. Why? Because I'm at a lower level of consciousness than the Father. That's why. I'm the lower level seeking the upper level. And that's why I pray, to make a union between the upper and the lower. That's all. Not to outline to God what's wrong. Nothing of the sort. I have an omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent Father. How egotistical would it be for me to say, God, let me tell you, let me enlighten God as to what's wrong. And so all I need do is make the contact. And the contact is made, and then our Father who knoweth our needs, he doeth the works. Now you can't have a simpler prayer or a more effective one. Our Father which art in heaven, I'm reaching up to your consciousness now, the higher consciousness, the divine consciousness. Man of earth is reaching up to the divine consciousness. Hallowed be thy name. Hallowed. Now that's just not holy or sanctified or glorified. It's saying that God is the source of his universe, the law, the activity, the one, the allness, the sum and substance of it all. Everything must emanate from the Father. You can't go out and get it from another man. You can't get your health from anyone else. You can't get your supply from anyone else. Everything comes from that hallowed Father. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done. Now, what is this kingdom? What is this will that we want done on earth as it is in heaven? You might say the kingdom of God is the one infinite church of the universe. Creation. The true, invisible, spiritual creation is the kingdom. That is where we find the thought forms of the Father, made of the mind of God, the essence of divine mind, made of divine consciousness. pure, perfect spiritual forms of light. That's the kingdom. Thy will be done. I'm stepping aside. I'm not telling you how to solve my problems. I'm stepping aside, and I'm not saying that I want you to do my will at all. I'm saying whatever your will, even if it raises up mine enemy against me, thy will be done. It's that simple. I have no human desire. Thy will be done. But not just for this instance, forever. This isn't a prayer for a momentary involvement with God. All prayer is a permanent involvement with God, not because of a momentary situation. Prayer is a permanent restatement of your position as one with God. And that your finite mind is not going to stand there directing God, but rather you're letting the infinite will of the Father, the infinite blueprint of creation, function through you, the instrument for that will. So far, we haven't asked God for a single thing. We haven't made a single request. All we've done is to say, Father, I recognize you as the source, and I lay my life down so that you may use it as you will. And implicit in this is the understanding that the Father knoweth the purpose for which he made us, and how stupid it would be for the creature to tell the Creator what to do, or when to do it, how quickly to do it, and what quantities. Now we're coming into a oneness with God. We're letting the consciousness of God come through the individual consciousness. There is a union of the individual soul and the divine soul as the one soul, a recognition that the soul of God is the soul of man, individualized. We're releasing into our experience the power of God by removing the human barrier, me. Give us this day our daily bread. There is a passage in the Bibles where the Israelites try to hoard up this daily bread. They try to get this manna and store it away, and it's spoiled. But there's a depth here. Remembering the message of the parables is always more than one meaning. Don't be satisfied with the surface. Now, first we know we're not talking about the bread we get out of the bakery. In fact, in John, Jesus tells us the bread he's talking about. He's talking about spiritual bread, the bread that comes from heaven. The divine manna, the divine substance. And the word daily is a very important word, because we're being told there not to store up this bread, not to have fear that tomorrow there won't be any. God is the same tomorrow as today. God knows your needs tomorrow as today. We're told not to fear, for tomorrow God will be here. Give us our daily bread. And that's enough for us today. We trust that tomorrow we'll have our daily bread again. you get another slant on the word bread. If you look into the Aramaic language, there's a word there, lakma. In this case, it's the word that bread comes from in the translation. And it means food as well as bread. And this particular food was served with every meal. There's no meal that they ever had without lakma. It was the very basis of their diets. And when you invited somebody to come to dine, you didn't even say, come have dinner at our house. You said, come have some lakma with us. And the reason it was used so much is because of the scarcities in those days. When wheat was scarce, it had to be stored up in the barns. And as it was stored, hoarded, the word lakma became more and more a very vital word, like gold, you might say. And people began to be conditioned to store it up, store it up. Store it up. You see, they weren't aware of the permanence of God in their lives. And this phrase here, give us this day our daily bread, is Jesus taking them out of this belief that God wouldn't be around tomorrow. Forgive us our debts. And you could use other words there, trespasses, sins, failings. It means forgive us, God, for what we owe you and haven't given you yet. Forgive us. But it's more than that, than forgiveness. There is in this phrase here a great revelation. At this particular time in history, man was of the opinion that the cause and effect law, the karma law, the sowing and reaping law, was something you had to work out for many generations. And that the sons were paying the price of the sins of their ancestors. And that if you committed a crime of some sort, you were consigned to balance that up for maybe the next 5,000 years. And here he's revealing that you can now set aside the law of cause and effect. You're not bound to the past. He's taking them out of time. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Just as we owe things to you, we made some rash promises, God. We have a lot of failings, we know it. And we're going to forgive those who are indebted to us. And we know that as we forgive those who are indebted to us, we will be forgiven by you. This revelation shows you right there that the law of karma can be broken. I'm not talking just about money debts. You can be indebted to people in many ways. Lead us not into temptation. I think you might have had a comma there if there had been a good stenographer around at the time. And lead us, comma. Because you know God wasn't going to lead them into temptation. Lead us. Because if you don't, we're going to walk right into temptation. And let's take that word temptation and take it right out of this temptations of the flesh. Sure, that's included. But there are 500 more temptations. And they're all around us right now. The big temptation is to disregard the will of God and to follow our own personal desires. lead us away from personal sense, our own will instead of thine. Separate us from the evil of personal sense, from duality, from a house divided. And you know, the rest of it, in some translations, wasn't even there. For thine is the power and the kingdom and the glory forever. Now, that's a rather superficial understanding of it. But sit back a moment and look at it. Now, for its omissions rather than what it does say, and see how ridiculous our human prayers have been. Here's the Master teaching us how to pray, and never once do we ask for a single thing of this world. We don't ask for a Cadillac, we don't ask for a better home, we don't ask for a job, we don't ask to be healed of a disease. What a strange prayer. But he calls it prayer. It's an answer to his disciples saying to him, teach us how to pray. Do you see that it is not an asking for anything, but rather a recognition of what is? Do you see that prayer is never asking for anything, but rather acknowledging the allness of God, coming into oneness with God, integrating our individual consciousness with His consciousness? What a different way to pray. Then if we look at the healings, we see a wonderful thing. In all of the healings, save maybe one or two, make them sit down, and they all eat. No prayer. Lazarus, come forth. Bear the water to the governor. Stretch forth thine arm. Pick up thy bed and walk. Are these prayers as we know them? But do you know the Master was praying? It isn't visible to a superficial reading, but he was praying, and that's the way the healings came about, through prayer, but not the human prayer that we're acquainted with, a different kind of prayer, a prayer so powerful that he was able to show us the very things that we're seeking in our present society, the abolition, the eradication of mental and physical diseases. The lifting of individuals out of bondage to the senses. And yet he did it without saying, God, help these people. So we'll have to study how he did it. Let's have a little silence before our rest period.